The cinema specialists are back with another episode of You Haven't Seen That, and today we are talking Aliens and Edge of Tomorrow, two movies, sci-fi action movies, great fun movies with badass female leads, and we thought this would pair really nicely this week with the success of Furiosa, and then Furiosa had no success, and so here we are blabbing about these two movies. For anybody who's tuning in just to the beginning of this, after this week, John and I are going to take a little break for the month of June, give ourselves a little R&R. We'll still be doing the $5 Tuesdays. We just recorded our Rocky II episode, which is coming out next week, so don't worry. But we are going to take a little R&R, a little break from the YouTube channel, and we're going to jump back in July, right before the release of Deadpool and Wolverine, so we can go through the remaining Marvel movies that we haven't done. We'll go back to doing a Marvel movie and a theatrical release up through Deadpool versus Wolverine. And then we will figure out something else. You have to stay tuned for all that. But for right now, we're doing Aliens and Edge of Tomorrow, two movies I'm really excited to talk about. But before we jump into those, since we really haven't been talking for a half hour on any of these movies anyway, what in the world is going on with the U.S. box office right now? Is it just done? Like, what in the world happened over Memorial Day? It's a disaster.
It is, which is really weird because Memorial Day is usually one of the largest movie weekends in the year, every year, right? Like annually, it is one of the largest movie-going weekends ever. Maybe there weren't movies that appealed. I think studios thought Furiosa was going to be the major big box office blockbuster this year, and it turned out it wasn't. Because it turns out that the Mad Max franchise doesn't actually have a lot of fans.
Yeah.
And it has some very diehard fans and some people who really love it. But I think they kind of got confused by the success Fury Road had, not so much at the box office, but with critics and with very vocal cinephiles in regards to the movie. It's a very well-regarded film. That doesn't translate to box office success, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, I always would talk about Fury Road with people who would, you know, my uncles, my dad, you know, people who are more into dialogue. They're used to the 70s movies. That's what they grew up on, right? 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. where action normally took a backseat. You get some good action movies in there. I mean, obviously Star Wars was coming out and everything, but for the most part, the classics from that era are movies that are very dialogue and based. And I would always be like, no, Fury Road just captured what you can do with film. Think mm-hmm. about what you can do with film. There's barely any dialogue in that movie. It's a gigantic car chase, but it is so visual. It's absolutely incredible. You can remember everything from that movie. I have seen two of the other three Mad Max movies. Couldn't tell you a single second of either of them because I didn't care. They didn't resonate with me. I was not into it at all. And that includes The Road Warrior. It really didn't do much. Maybe I gave it a good review, but I don't remember it. I remember everything from Fury Road, which might help also that we did it for our top 100. So if you want to hear a Fury Road podcast, go listen to it in our top 100 countdown. But it's fascinating to me how hard it is to sell people on that franchise still, despite mm-hmm. the success of Fury Road. Whereas the Planet of the Apes movie now in retrospect, absolutely knocked it out of the park. I mean, I couldn't be happier with the Planet of the Apes. If this happens to the Planet of the Apes doesn't get another movie. Mm-hmm. Did the Planet of the Apes have the greatest success of all time? No, not by any means. It only made $305 million worldwide. And I think the budget was, $150 million? I forget exactly what it was. But the thing is, $160 million and it's made $305 worldwide. So not great, but not terrible. Furiosa just made $26 million opening weekend. Put that into perspective, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes made $58 million, and Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes moved off of Memorial Day weekend because it was scared of Furiosa, and it just wiped the floor with Furiosa. Furiosa ain't hitting $100 million. It might not even hit $70 million. That's how much of a disaster this was. And it just really shocked me because I thought we were coming into this, and hey, right now we actually have a good amount of people watching. So if you're watching, please like this video. get the views up on these videos. Make us happy. Seeing 70 views on the last one makes me sad, although we're killing it with listens. I think people just don't want to look at us, John. That's the problem, which, by the way, now, if anybody's wondering, John is bald, so he did shave his head. So maybe that gives you more incentive to tune into the YouTube channel. But I thought when we were doing Aliens and Edge of Tomorrow, Aliens, I expected to have a draw. I mean, look, Aliens is a sick, epic action movie. James Cameron, Sigourney Weaver, Bill Paxton, and maybe the greatest role of all time. We'll talk about that. Can't wait to. And it's a sequel in an unbelievably popular franchise. I figured that would do it. Edge of Tomorrow, that's going into our, if you haven't seen it, you should see it. Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, Doug Liman movie. It's so much fun. You got to check it out. But I was expecting there to be so much hype coming off of Furiosa when we were doing these. And when you texted me, because I forget what I was even doing Monday, but you texted me and said, this made $32 million on a three-day weekend. And I was like, oh my God, what an absolute disaster. And I don't root for this stuff. I know some people will sit there and root for it. And I know, like, I follow, you know, obviously I follow a lot of survivors and stuff like that. And some people, not even survivors, but just people in general will try to turn it into a political thing of, oh, there's going to be the people who are stoked that it didn't make money because it's a female driven movie. And there's going to be other people who are like more defensive of it because it's a female driven movie. At the end of the day, if it's a good movie, I hope that it makes a boatload of money so they keep making good movies. Mm-hmm. But this is going to scare people away like crazy, because if you're making this movie, if you're Warner Brothers, you think you have a done deal. I mean, you think you are locked in with a massive success after what Fury Road did. And instead, you have one of the biggest box office flops ever. The budget for Fury Road was $150 million. Mm-hmm. It made $154 domestic, $226 international for a total of $380. 154 domestic, barely breaks even on the budget. You figure there's a lot of P&A, but then it won the awards and everything like that. Furiosa is not winning awards.
No.
And so this is bad. And maybe is Tom Hardy, was he just that much of a bigger draw back in 2015 than Chris Hemsworth is now? Are people tired of the Avengers people?
I don't think so. I don't think that's it, because quite frankly, I did end up seeing Furiosa this weekend and I wasn't going to. I just had a friend who asked me if I wanted to go, and I was like, sure, I'll go. Because I had my concerns about this movie, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, where I think there are some points that, as to why it kind of flopped as much as it did. Mm-hmm. But Chris Hemsworth was the best part of this movie, by a lot, in my opinion.
Was he?
So,
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I don't know if it's a appeal thing. I think what it really comes down to is you're making a prequel to a film that was very one-off when it first originally came out. It relied heavily on word of mouth to get people out seeing it in the first place. It was in a time where more people were going to the movies. That was also 9 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that isn't being taken into consideration with this. This movie is a prequel to a movie that came out 9 years ago that had this like massive cult following. Yes, it had a bunch of awards and stuff that were brought on by physical spectacle and then practical effects that were kind of put away. As soon as I saw the first trailer for Furiosa, I was like, that's a lot more CGI than I want to be seeing in my sequel to Fury Road. And yes, people had been clamoring for a Furiosa movie because of Charlize Theron's performance in Fury Road and what she brought to that character. So if making this prequel to, you know, a beloved movie, but having a different actress playing the character when that was really what people were glomming onto was already a risky proposition. You released it on Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, again, movies are moving away from it because they're scared of how successful this movie was. Maybe we're just at a point where studios have no idea what can be successful.
I don't think they know. I don't think they know. I think, you know, we've talked about it before on this podcast, but I think that sometimes these places are so unbelievably over concerned with, you know, the AI of it all. The we're going to put out something for this trailer and AI is going to make this trailer based on what they think people want. People are people. They're not robots. Like, no matter how much you throw this AI stuff out there, no matter how much you do this, it doesn't matter. People want to have human reactions to it. You can put all of whatever you want into the trailer. You can throw Anya Taylor-Joy in there because you think that a badass view of her driving is going to work. But you know, what a glorious day, or what a lovely day, whatever the hell Nicholas Hoult says in that first trailer for Fury Road is burned into my brain for eternity, even though I can't remember the exact word he says. But it's like you could still envision it so well, and you could see the guy with the guitar going back and forth, back and forth. And honestly, the trailer for this movie looked generic. And I think that at this point, I think Hollywood is getting more and more scared to make movies that are taking risks and are outside of what the box is telling them to do. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a stupid thing to say, but Oppenheimer and Barbie weren't risks last year. You know what I mean? Like, Barbie, you could say was a risk, but you throw Greta Gerwig, Margot Robbie, and you pretty much turn it into a meme, and look at what happens. You got to get back to, who are you aiming for? What is your target audience? And right now, I don't think a lot of these people know what their target audience is. And it always was that the target audience was 18 to 24-year-old men, right? Teenage men to early 20s men. That was the biggest moving-going audience there was for the longest period of time. I don't know if that's still the truth. It might not be that anymore. It might be that it's people in their late 20s, early 30s, men and women. It might be moving to that, and it might just be something that these studios need to take a look at. Obviously, you're always trying to get the youth, because the youth is your future. But while you're getting the youth with your, you know, Marvel movies and whatever, you got to find a way to get everybody else in the theater. And for some, I mean, I didn't go this weekend. I have the Regal pass to go in and see two movies. I can see as many movies as I want. If I see two, it covers me for the month. And I didn't go this weekend, and I wasn't doing anything Sunday or Monday. Like, I could have gone to see Furiosa, and I simply chose not to, even though it would have cost me nothing. And so we'll see how that ends up going moving forward, and how scared they are. And John, you brought up a good point to me. Maybe we should go back to making $10 to $50 million budget movies instead of putting all of your eggs in one basket and failing. Because this is the second massive failure in a row. The Fall Guy was $140 million, and that did worse than Furiosa.
Yeah, well, that movie was also really bad. I ended up watching it. It was not good.
I've heard nothing but good things. You're the first one to say that, honestly.
Yeah, it was not a good movie. But
actually, it did better than Furiosa. That's the crazy part.
Oh, I mean, that's wild. Yeah. That's wild. That a movie that came out a month beforehand did better than a movie launched on Memorial Day. It's just unheard of. No one.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is the only success right now.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was Cord Jefferson said when he got his Oscar that they make, instead of making one $150 million movie, make 15-10 million dollar movies. I think studios need to listen to that now, and I think this is becoming more and more clear. And I think the more big blockbuster failures we get, we're going to start seeing a shift to these smaller independent films again, because those are also the movies that are doing well at the box office.
The killer for this, and then we'll dive into the movies we're actually supposed to be talking about. The killer for those smaller independent movies was the decline of physical media, because you would make those movies, they'd make their 15 million. And then that was when, you know, you would get your 18 to 24 year old men who would be like, I gotta go buy that. I gotta go buy that. And then you'd get the dads who would go and rent it so that they could watch it, because they didn't want to see it in the theater. And then you're getting more eyes on it. And the decline of physical media took out so much money that could be made. And as far as I know, the streamers aren't going to pay as much for a lower budget movie because they don't feel like it's going to be as valuable to them. It's not going to get as many eyes. Bring back Blockbuster. You bring back Blockbuster, you fix the film industry. Don't tell anyone.
But tell everyone. I want that back so bad.
And what happens, John, if you bring back Blockbuster, if you bring back video stores, what happens? You get the pain in the ass moviegoers, the younger people right now, because they are on their phones. I mean, down here in Florida, they like to run in and out of the movie theater over and over again and make as much noise as possible. They like to yell at you when you get up to like, just like go say something to somebody else to get them out of the theater. They're awful. That keeps them home on a Friday night, because now they can go rent a movie and hang out with all their friends and talk and do whatever. And that's fine. And they don't do that now because it's like, oh, well, this is something to do. Let them go to Blockbuster and spend 2 hours being out, rent two movies, and come home.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about Edge of Tomorrow first, because I feel like that ties in a little bit better to this conversation, being that Edge of Tomorrow had a budget of, drumroll please, $178 million in 2014. 10 years ago, this movie had a budget of $178 million. And guess what? From Warner Brothers, disaster opening weekend. $28 million. Not much better than Furiosa. So that's where I think it ties in here. Ended up making $100 million domestically, $270 million internationally for a grand total of $370 million. So overall, it was a success. It made its money back, even if it didn't do nearly as good as it would have liked to. Furiosa right now, for anybody wondering, has made $31 million internationally. So it's not going to come anywhere near $270 million internationally. But all that's just to say, we've seen studios making these mistakes over and over and over again. But Edge of Tomorrow is one that does shock me a little bit, being the time it came out that it didn't catch on better than it did. And maybe it was just the fact that at that time, Emily Blunt wasn't the huge turnout that she is now, even though she just did nothing in, what do you call it? In The Fall Guy. But like A Quiet Place is really what launched Emily Blunt. Yeah. And that was 2018. So that was after this.
Yeah. In consideration, like with Edge of Tomorrow, Tom Cruise was kind of in a lull in his career at this point too, in 2014. This was, Ghost Protocol had just come out.
Was that what it was?
Right. Like Ghost Protocol came out in,
I have to look,
2011, and Rogue Nation came out in 2015. So there was only one recent Mission Impossible movie at this time. He kind of like stepped away from acting for a little bit, with the whole like Marriage to Katie Holmes and Scientology thing. Because his role in Tropic Thunder really surprised a lot of people when all of a sudden he shows up in that movie, because he hadn't been acting for a while and he had slowly started getting back. Yes, Mission Impossible's back here, but he wasn't like the big box office pull that he used to be, because you hit 2014 and all of a sudden the movie star doesn't exist anymore, right? Not a pull. And I think we are getting back into a time when the movie star is enough to bring people into films again, but we're not quite to the same extent we were when Tom Cruise was at its heyday in the 90s and aughts.
And the problem was, before this, he had done Rock of Ages, Jack Reacher, Oblivion.
Yeah.
Those are not successes. Like, those were movies, like, you're 100% right that Tom Cruise had fallen off to a serious extent coming into this movie. So to take the $178 million risk on him was very, very, you know, surprising. And it ended up paying off mostly. It also kind of like revitalized him, because then he came out and he did the next Mission Impossible movie. And then his career really took off again, because obviously Tom Cruise has always been popular. It's just more of like he was up, he was down, he was up, he was down, he was up, he was down. But for Emily Blunt, she had done Looper, which was a successful movie. She had done The Muppets, but she's not the star of that. And she had done The Adjustment Bureau. Other good movies, Sunshine Cleaning, if you've never seen that, anything like that. But I'm just saying, those were the recent movies before this. This was a ballsy $178 million movie. If this was made this year, you wouldn't really think twice about it. It's Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, even though Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt just faltered. But to make this in 2014 was pretty shocking, especially Doug Liman as a director. John, do you know what Doug Liman's most popular movie is other than Edge of Tomorrow?
No idea.
So his other most popular movie, if you were going to say based off of Letterboxd, is Mr. and Mrs. Smith. He also did
The Brangelina one?
Yep. He also did Swingers. He did Go, which you still haven't watched. And he did The Bourne Identity.
Huh. Okay.
But again, even though he did some legitimate movies, not a household name.
No,
not a household name. Do you know who wrote the script for Edge of Tomorrow?
No.
Christopher McQuarrie.
Oh. All of a sudden, things are starting to make more sense.
Doesn't it all start making more sense? For anybody who doesn't know what Christopher McQuarrie has done, Mission Impossible Fallout, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Top Gun Maverick, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Jack Reacher, The Mummy, Valkyrie, and of course, The Usual Suspects. So that's Christopher McQuarrie's lineup. And so, but again, at this point, Christopher McQuarrie wasn't really having success either. He was working a lot with Tom Cruise, but Valkyrie wasn't a great success. The Mission Impossibles weren't a great success. So just the way that this movie even got made was surprising. The reviews were phenomenal. The American box office was bad. The international box office was very good and ultimately saved the movie. But now let's actually talk about the movie. But those are all the parallels pretty much to Furiosa, right? Like, this is what I'm trying to say here is, and this movie had better success than Furiosa, because I think in 2014, people were just more willing to go to the movies. You had gotten rid of pretty much video stores, but you hadn't completely gotten rid of physical media yet. I mean, we were still going to the DVD store, essentially, right across the street from our campus at Miami in 2014. Yeah. What, now that I've said all that, what do you think about Edge of Tomorrow as a movie?
I contributed to the box office of this movie when it first came out. I went and saw it opening weekend. Just like a friend of mine and I were just like, let's go see this movie. It looks kind of neat. This movie surprised the hell out of me when I first saw it. It impressed me so much. It is such a fun action sci-fi film, and it is handled in such a great way. Yes, it's based off of the Japanese light novel, All You Need Is Kill. And like, there are some changes from the novel that some people complain about, but whatever. Like, I didn't know that. This is just a Groundhog Day movie that's really fun, that has aliens and some cool technology and stuff. It's handled really well. It's a great cast. And quite frankly, it's exactly what I was expecting going into the movie, but I didn't expect it to be as good as it was.
Yeah, that's how I feel too, right? Like, it kind of, you know, the Source Code had come out before this, which follows a similar trajectory, the Duncan Jones movie with Jake Gyllenhaal, where, you know, he keeps reliving the same train accident over and over again, and he's trying to figure out how to, you know, solve that. So it was a trope that had been done, but it holds up really well. And I think it holds up so well because it does just have fun with it. It doesn't get into the seriousness of it all. And what it really capitalizes on is it establishes the stakes very early. It establishes the rules very early. A lot of these movies want to keep the rules for the twist at the end. But the fact of he killed an alpha, the alpha bled on him. He mixed the blood with the alpha. And because of that, now he's restarting the day because his blood is shared with the Omega. It's simple. I mean, it's convoluted, sure. But all of these movies are going to have convoluted plot points about all that. And I think it does a really good job of establishing what the rules are right off the bat, so we have no questions moving forward. Great, I'm in. Let me sit down. Let me watch this movie. And let me just go along for the ride. And, you know, in the hands of a lesser writer, it probably doesn't have that kind of success. But, you know, then you can just watch Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt get into it. We believe why they're working together. We understand how Cruise is able to consistently convince people that he does know more and how he can convince them to work with him and like how they learn, right? Because that's always the problem with these movies is how do you learn when you don't remember it, but the other people do? And the fact that Emily Blunt had been through it before, so she was the connection there, it just does a really good job across the board. And the budget is used well because these monsters, the mimics, still look amazing 10 years later.
It's really interesting because I was watching them and I mean, I just got into a James Cameron mood this week. So I also watched Terminator 2 this week. And like, they had that same type of feel as the T-1000 does, where they're that fluid movement between them. And because of that, and because they're kind of ever changing and they don't really ever take a full form, they're more believable. It's like that whole idea of like obscuring in shadows. And they're just obscuring the graphics in movement, and yes, you can tell they're CGI, but at the same time, it's like it almost feels okay because of what they're going for in the movements of these creatures.
Yeah, I totally agree. They make them very robotic, but then they also clearly have personalities, and you know, they, what is it, they're a perfect world takeover machine is essentially what they're called at one point during this movie, and you buy into it. And it's also a cool design. I think about like Arrival, obviously came out after this movie, but Arrival also had a cool design for what the alien creatures were going to look like. I mean, too often the alien creatures in these movies look too humanoid, or they're just blobs. And I think the fact that these were really fast, that they're scary, that they can hide, they can do all of that stuff, really, you know, elevates this movie. And and the storytelling structure just allows it to whip along and get the personalities. And also it leans into the same way Aliens does, and we'll talk about that. It leans into the corny, you know, military grunt dialogue that's over the top and everything, but it's winking at you and it's having fun with it rather than trying to take itself so seriously. I think that's where Cameron, with the Avatar movies, the conversations they're having, you're rolling your eyes so often because you're like, oh my God, just shut up. And in this movie, they're doing it intentionally. Bill Paxton's character is great, how it's so over the top. You know, I really appreciate that in Edge of Tomorrow, because this is a movie that if it falls on the wrong side of the tone it's going for, it's a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the tone is so important to this film because, like you said, yes, there's a convoluted reasoning behind everything. The storyline, pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And like everything about the world, like most action sci-fi films, we get like, you know, our 5-minute montage of news clippings at the beginning of the movie to set us up. But we learn absolutely everything we need to know there that like catches up with all the in-world characters. And then we get the additional exposition later with the Alpha and the resetting of the day and how this and it explains everything, because that's the big thing. Throughout the beginning of this movie, we're told they have no idea we're coming, we're easily going to win this.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a bloodbath and they are completely ambushed, and you are like, how did they know this was happening? Because we don't know anything. And then we get that exposition later, it's like, oh, this makes sense. And then we have that the explanation that they are that the mimics just wait until the dominant species on a planet attacks them. Mm-hmm. And then they start taking over. It's like, that's genius. It's such clean and clear writing that it lets you focus on the tone, which is fun. That's what this movie's going for. It's like, oh my God, the world's ending, but we're still having fun watching it end.
Yeah, every time Tom Cruise dies, you do get a little chuckle, right? Every time when he rolls under the truck and gets run over, and Bill Paxton goes, what the hell were you thinking? And then it just cuts to him back in the place. And when you come to the realization that he's been killed, you know, thousands of times at this point, like it's just, it's very enjoyable. It's very entertaining. And this was the type of movie that needed to be more entertaining than try to go and say, oh, look how original we are. Because at the end of the day, the story's not all that original. Like I said, it's been done numerous times. This is just done really well. And you even just said it's straightforward. It's the human life is at stake. The world is at stake and they need to win. And how are they going to do this? The worst part of the movie to me is the convoluted beginning of how Tom Cruise gets thrown into the entire situation. But after that gets settled, it just rolls. And it's just a really fun movie. And I guess like part of me is always like, how did Emily Blunt go on to be as successful as she did with this movie not being a huge domestic success? And it's nothing, I'm not saying Emily Blunt's a great actress. I love Emily Blunt. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying like part of me does sit here and say, how did she go on to have the success she had? And why were they still willing to take so many risks on her after this movie really did not make anything?
Well, I mean, you already mentioned that like her big movie was The Quiet Place that really brought her into the mainstream, and she was kind of cast by her husband in that movie.
That's true.
So that helped.
I mean, Sicario was the year after
that. That is true.
Sicario wasn't a huge budget movie, but that definitely put her on the map in a huge way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's one of the things with Emily Blunt that is really underappreciated, and it was kind of one of the disappointing things with The Fall Guy too, is like that movie seemed like it was an action comedy, but Emily Blunt's kind of like sidelined in that movie and not participating in it. But we see movies like Sicario, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, and Edge of Tomorrow, where we understand that Emily Blunt can really be this badass woman who is tackling these action scenes and stuff and should be given the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, and she has now. I mean, you look, you know, I mean, she's in the Jungle Cruise, which was obviously a Disney action, you know, a Disney action movie. We'll see how she rebounds after The Fall Guy, because she's definitely up and down. That's for sure. I mean, she did The Girl on the Train, which I don't know if that was a success, to be completely honest.
I don't think so. But
what? So now
she also was nominated for an Oscar this year.
That is true. I mean, yeah, we can't look past that. She's just such a small role in that. What did you think about? Have you seen Looper?
Yeah, I love Looper.
Okay. Okay. Cause she's really good in Looper. And I feel like that was like her first real introduction. It's funny to me with Emily Blunt that she became an action star, not saying that she didn't deserve it, because we just talked about, like, she is very good in these. It's just like, she is thin, you know, I guess she's tall, so that helps, but she's not like overly muscular in any way. Right. And there's just, I just find it a little interesting. Like, you look at Sigourney Weaver, and like Sigourney Weaver does have like more muscle tone to her back in the Aliens movies. And I feel like Emily Blunt, it's very much like, she's sexy. Look at her. She can go beat up these things. But I don't know. It's just like, it's interesting to me that she became a action star. She gets her nomination for Oppenheimer. But if you think about any other movie, you know, Emily Blunt from, other than probably The Devil Wears Prada or Mary Poppins.
Or Mary Poppins, yeah.
She's just action, action, action.
I think a lot of it comes down to the fact, I mean, it's something we don't usually talk about here, but it's just the evolving way that the world's changed their approach at, like, looking at badass women and just action stars in general, right? Action stars don't need to be these bulky, beefy men and women anymore. We've kind of gone to a point where we've gotten more like every man than every woman characters in these type of movies. And I think because of that, you can have someone like Emily Blunt get into that role as just a much better audience surrogate than someone like a Sigourney Weaver, or like, even if we're thinking of like more common, like tropey female action star or like action actresses right now, like someone like a Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah. That's a good point for sure. There was another thing I was going to ask, and then it totally fell out of my head. Yeah, it totally went out of my head, John. I was going to ask you something else about...
How do you feel about the twist of this movie that the Omega kind of knew what was going on the entire time and was leading them astray?
So I think what my biggest question regarding this is, like, look, I'm willing to go along with it. I gave this movie 3 stars at the end of the day. I'm willing to go along with the story. If the Omega knows what's going on, why isn't the Omega doing something to Tom Cruise to make the Tom Cruise thing end? Because Tom Cruise gets to keep, you know, changing the day, starting the day over. Doesn't the Omega know that? And wouldn't the Omega also be learning, or no?
So there is a little bit of discussion where the visions start appearing the closer they get to figuring out where you are. So it sounds like, based on the explanation given in the film, that the Omega, like, has that connection with the alphas and resets whenever a alpha dies, but doesn't know which alpha it is that's causing that to happen. So, and based on the learning that we see Tom Cruise go through, it's not like a hive mind is learning. It's like the entity that's resetting is learning. So I think only the Omega's learning at that point. It has to communicate to the rest of the mimics as to what needs to happen. And the visions are the Omega trying to get to a point where they're luring Cage to this dam in order to bleed him out and stop him from resetting the day.
That makes sense. Okay. I think I just totally missed that, to be honest. But that definitely makes plenty of sense. And I think, yeah, that just went in one ear and out the other for me.
What I don't understand is why, after they defeat the Omega, everything's reset.
That's what I said to my wife at the end. I said, does that mean he just can't die?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And like, it's okay.
Recognize him.
Yeah. Right. Like, I'm okay just suspending my disbelief, whatever. I get it. I just don't understand why the day reset and it was But the difference is the Omega's been blown up.
Mm-hmm. I also found that to be a little weird. So I am in with you on that, of that being a little strange, of like, what is the deal with that? I don't really know. I think it was kind of a cop-out ending. I don't think they had the answer.
So I think the answer is, this is an American ending.
It is.
And that's because Americans like clean, tight, and like, this is North Americans in general, prefer clean, tidy, and happy endings. The original light novel this is based off of, the character has to die in order to like fulfill everything at the end. And he has got to be like the sacrifice to stop everything from happening.
Mm-hmm.
That type of ending doesn't fly with your general North American audience.
No,
they don't
true.
Like that type of ambiguous ending, and they don't like that type of downer ending. They prefer happy endings. So yeah. Instead we get this confusing ending, but it's okay because everything's good now.
It is a very confusing ending. It is an ending that just kind of comes out of nowhere. And I get, you know, like, the other thing that confuses me is now he's flying in and Brendan Gleeson is talking, and this gets into the whole time travel mentality of, okay, so why was he flying there then? They're mm-hmm. like, so nice. Wasn't the whole reason he was flying there originally for Brendan Gleeson to kind of like screw him over? So I don't know, man. I feel
the
like
the implication from it is that he was already on the plane at that point in time when, I don't know. It doesn't make sense. It also doesn't make sense that it goes back 2 days instead of 1 day.
Yeah.
The ending, it doesn't make sense. But also, Brendan Gleeson's in this movie, and that kind of took me off guard when I started watching it.
I like Brendan Gleeson, though.
I also like Brendan Gleeson. I just forgot he was in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he plays such a small role, and by this point now we're used to seeing him in larger roles for sure. So I could, mm-hmm. you know, I get what you're saying on that. All right. Should we jump over to Aliens, or do you have anything else you want to say about this?
Yeah, let's jump over to Aliens, because this is a movie that impressed me a lot more this time than the first time I watched it.
Yeah, I love Aliens. There was a period where I said Aliens was better than Alien. I think what I ultimately like Alien more for is the suspense that it builds throughout. Mm. It does a really good job with the first act. Where Aliens on a second watch, the first act, you know, it is a little cheesy, and you know, there is some of that. But again, going into Edge of Tomorrow and Aliens have a lot in common. They really do. And they really lean into the fun of it all and the excitement of it all. And James Cameron's good at making a sequel. Not the second Avatar, but the Terminator 2 and this, like, he does a really good job with those things. So I really do love Aliens. I think this is a 4-star movie. I think it's one of the quintessential action movies of all time.
I don't quite have it a 4-star. When I originally saw this, so this is actually the last Alien movie I saw. I'd seen every other Alien movie, but I had never seen Aliens until a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, whatever. It's an action movie. I get it. There, I had my qualms with a few things. I bumped it up to 3.5 stars this time, because I still think this girl who plays Newt is terrible in this movie, and like,
she's barely in it though.
Takes the movie down 0.5 star for me.
Oh, come on. She's barely in the movie.
There's another thing that like takes it down a bit, and I really noticed it on this watch. But this, what James Cameron can do in shifting genres is phenomenal. Because again, like I said, I watched T2 this week too, and we talked about the original Terminator on one of our $5 Tuesdays a while ago on the Patreon. So if you haven't checked that out, go check that out, or become a patron so you can check that out. Yeah. And
good plug, John.
It's the original Terminator is like a sci-fi horror movie in the end, right? Like, it kind of has that like slasher feel to it, the way it's gone through. And Alien also obviously is an isolation horror. So what James Cameron can do in taking horror movies and switching them to the action genre mm-hmm. is phenomenal. And what he does here, and I really notice it this time through, is he really pays a lot of respect to the same type of suspense Scott builds up in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't see an alien until an hour into this movie.
Oh, yeah. And that first action sequence when they get there and they're doing it half through the the cameras and everything like that. That is one of like my core memories as a child. I freaking loved that scene as a kid. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. That's a scene that still is in my brain all the time. Like, that might be part of the reason why I wanted to make movies, you know, to tell stories. It's just that scene is so incredibly well done. But you're right. When I was watching it this time, I said, okay, when the hell does that scene happen? Because I remember it happening because it has to, they have to kill the Sarge early in the movie. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's going to happen. And it doesn't happen for so long. And I think he does do a good job of building the suspense. I just think you see some of the hiccups in Cameron's writing style in the early portion of the movie, which is the only knock I give this movie. I give this movie 4 stars because the action's incredible, the makeup, the production design, the story 90% of the time. The thing that bothers me the most from this movie is when Ripley wakes up, she does everything. She goes in, she meets with the people, and they say, we have colonists over there and everything's fine. And then that night, they're knocking on her door saying, we've lost contact with the colonists. Why not just have it start with, we've lost contact with the colonists? Like, do you have a reason for this? I see you smiling. Like, did I miss something while I was watching?
No, because I thought about this too. And the way I decided to interpret this scene this time is they just didn't bother to see if the colonists were still there before. They kind of like shut them off and forgot about them. And they're like, oh yeah, we should probably check in on them. Now that Ripley's like talking about them, it's like, oh no, we can't get a hold of them. There's probably something going on there.
Yeah.
It's just like how I felt about it. The weird thing that for me in the opening part of this movie is Ripley's nightmare with the chest burster.
Because it's happening when there's serious conversation going on.
It's like, hey, by the way, it's been 57 years. It's like, okay, is that a like core thing that Ripley is like having this nightmare about? This idea that it's been 57 years, which would make sense. And this is getting into my biggest qualm with this movie. There is a very important deleted scene from this movie. Do you know about it?
No. Oh, is that the one where she... No, that's the first movie where she talks to Russell. Or whatever.
It's the one where she explains she had a daughter that she is now younger than.
And they cut that from the movie.
They cut it from the movie. And it's so important to this movie. Because it explains everything about the way that Ripley is approaching Newt. And the maternal instincts she shows. And the maternal instincts of Ripley are so important. Because it's reflected in the alien queen who is the big bad of the film.
Wow. That's crazy.
And that's why I'll never give this movie 4 stars. Because it, like, but I did focus more on the maternal side of Ripley this time, knowing that fact. And it does elevate the film quite a lot. And it does, when you think about the fact that the alien queen is this big bad, and Ripley has to kill the alien queen herself, that's a lot more poignant than, oh, here's this action movie with all of these Marines going in and, like, dying to this aggressive alien force. It does help elevate the movie. But I needed to know external information to know about that.
I'm sorry, I keep yawning too. I ran right before this and now I'm like dying. So I'm not actually tired. It's just sitting in this position is killing me. But no, man, that blows my mind. And I'm going to be honest with you. It pisses me off that they cut that. And I know that with the alien movies probably have some of the most talked about history of director confrontation, scenes that were cut that they didn't want cut. David Fincher directs Alien 3, wanted his name off of the project because the producers were so ridiculous. And the producers tried to blame David Fincher for why the movie is bad, which as we have moved through time, we all know is not true because David Fincher has made maybe one bad movie in his entire career. And so we all know that that was bullshit, but they were trying to take advantage of a young director and use that. The fourth movie is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who is one of the greatest directors of all time. And it essentially turned into a camp movie instead of an alien movie, which is super bizarre. The first Alien cut out the scene where she talks to Tom Selleck while he's cocooned. If you don't watch the director's cut. And now for this to happen with Aliens, I'm surprised I didn't know about this, and I'm surprised that this isn't a bigger part of like the cultural zeitgeist, because you're 100% right. The motherly instincts with Newt, why she would feel that, why it would kill her so much that it's 57 years. Also, if she's going to have the dream and have the thing pop out of her, that's very symbolic of giving birth Mm-hmm. So, you know, that would have made sense in there. This really blows my mind, John. You have officially
I've done it.
Hit me with something that I did not know. And I feel like I am mad at myself for going 32 years without knowing. So thank you so much for bringing this up, because that really does. I mean, look, this is a 4-star movie in my opinion, but now I want to watch the director's cut, because I feel like you watch the director's cut and this could be one of the all-time great movies. Because that is so important, because the relationship with Newt, why does she have to track down Newt? It's got to be more than just save the cat, right? This is a person we're talking about. Now it makes so much more sense. And yeah, to have to kill the queen at the end, who's just a mother. Yeah, dude. No, that's brutal.
No, it does elevate that. But when you know that and you watch this film, you see all of the underlying things and you understand so much. And it makes Ripley an even more compassionate character. Because one of the big things I think... we really equate Ripley and Sigourney Weaver in general with this badass female. I would say she's pretty much the quintessential female action star after Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already discussed Alien, obviously, when we were talking about our top 100, because both of us had it on our top 100. So if you haven't checked that out, go check that out and listen to us talk about the first movie. But Sigourney Weaver's kind of like the last expected person Ripley's the last person you expect to survive all of that. And you're really kind of surprised when the narrative switches over to her in that movie. And you see that it's her movie. And what James Cameron does really well in Aliens is still focus on that, but give her more depth. And give her more depth in a way where it's like, yes, she does have these genuinely maternal and like female oriented traits about her, but she's not a soldier, right? She's a dock worker.
Yeah. What was her exact role? Was it dock worker in the first movie?
No, in the first movie, they said it in this one, and it was just like flight something.
It was a civilian advisor to the U.S. Colonial Marine Corps. That's in the second one.
Yeah. But it was just like, hey, you work on the ship. And that was it. But the fact that she's not a military person, the fact that she, you know, there's that scene in this where Hicks is showing her how to use the gun.
She's right? A warrant officer.
There you go.
But
Hicks is showing her how to use the gun. And you're like, okay, this is like when we get into badass Ripley. How does she kill the alien queen at the end of this movie, though?
With the mech suit,
with the loader, with the dock loader that she is certified to use, because that was the only job she could get 57 years in the future.
Yep.
This is just like, all of a sudden Ripley's also this everyman who shuns this action star of using guns and stuff to use the tools of the average person to defeat this invading force.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And we see that at the beginning when she does it, you're like, oh, that's a throwaway scene. And then the fact that it ends up being how she fights off the alien at the end of the movie, which also the queen alien, the design on that is so incredible. Like it really is just so amazing.
So perfect.
Also the scene where the alien comes up out of the water on Newt is one of the best. Mm-hmm. I love the scene where they lock themselves in the room. And again, it is coming down to like the instincts, her natural human instincts are what are keeping her alive, not some superhuman power. Everybody else in this movie is better trained than she is. And yet her and the girl are the ones who survive. Have you ever seen Alien 3?
Yep.
How do you feel about the fact that they kill off Hicks and Newt before that movie even starts?
Bishop. Hicks is already dead.
No, Hicks isn't dead. Hicks is... Hicks has his head. Remember, he bangs his head and they put him in the thing. Hicks, Bishop in half, and Newt all get put into their little sleeps.
Right. It's been a long time since I've seen Alien 3. And I have no... I might revisit it now just because, like, after watching Aliens again. But honestly, with everything that I've learned about Aliens, it actually makes me so mad that Newt just dies right away. It's so inconsequential, and it's just... such a terrible way to start that film.
Yeah, they did a really bad job of James Cameron, I can't believe I'm saying this. James Cameron does such a good job with the character development in this movie. Holy shit. Okay. James Cameron does such a great job with the character development in this movie that it sucks that they just throw it all away at the start of it. Mm-hmm. They just say goodbye. We're done with that.
Because I mean, they also changed that script like multiple times too, though.
Oh, right? Yeah. I mean, it was a disaster. But I mean, you think about like going from Alien, she was the only one left. So you only had one way to really start that next movie. And then you do a great job of actually establishing these side characters. I mean, it actually is impactful when the side characters die in this movie. It's mm-hmm. very impactful when they die in Alien too, but to have these just be grunt military caricatures and make it impactful is very, very impressive. It's very well done. And so I just really like, I really like that and what like they're able to do. And then for them to just kill it all off at the beginning of Alien 3, it's like, well, that's
silly. It doesn't make sense, especially with everything that goes into developing these characters in this movie. I think Hicks is just like the relationship Ripley and Hicks have. It's nice because it never feels one of the best things about Aliens. It doesn't shoehorn in this romantic relationship that a lot of movies now, even Edge of Tomorrow, she's in that romantic type thing between the two leads, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Aliens doesn't do that. And there's a lot of restraint that goes into doing that. And because of that, Hicks just comes off as this, like, more of a mentor character somehow, who's just, like, also compassionate and showing this, like, human side of the army. And that's the interesting thing when we look at both this movie and The Edge of Tomorrow, is this idea of the army as people rather than an entity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I totally agree. And I just really, like, you know, we're talking about Hicks and everything like that, but like Paul Reiser as the scummy representative of the corporation, he's phenomenal.
Works the worst.
Lance Henriksen as the android is great. I mean, Bill Paxton obviously is the best, but even like William Hope as the mm-hmm. inexperienced Marine, it's like you are seeing all of those human sides in this movie that you could have easily just left out and just turned them into. This is Ripley's movie, and you just watch everybody else get killed. And instead, they do a good job of making each character different. They all have their unique relationships, their own unique personalities, and they don't all feel the same, which is really important, because to go from Alien, which is a ensemble piece, and then turn that into, okay, you're just waiting to watch, you know, Ripley be the last one standing. It's like, no, like we're actually putting more thought into this of what each character is going to do that's either going to get them killed or keep them alive. I mean, you know, you get the Gorman having his moment of heroism at the end of the movie with Vasquez and all of that. So yeah, I mean, that stuff really, really worked. And yeah, Michael Biehn, who's very funnily like barely in any other movies as Hicks, it's just a shame they totally butchered that for the next movie.
Yeah. But I mean, I want to circle back on Burke, who is the character from the corporation that I can't remember the name of, but this is probably one of the most despicable characters in a movie ever. This man who's like, oh, hey, Ripley, like, we're cool, right? Like, is all welcoming to Ripley at the beginning, and then it's like, yeah, you know what's really great? Money. So I'm going to smuggle an alien embryo inside you so I can make a lot of it.
It's fantastic. It really is.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really important to have that human villain in this movie. Because if the antagonist is just the aliens, this isn't different from the original. Mm-hmm. You need to
have in the original, it's just the aliens.
Exactly. Right? Well, I mean, like, there's the android thing who does represent the company and everything, and like bringing it back and all, which is similar to this. But
to get a human choosing to do it.
That's the thing. It's the choice. Because there are... I don't know if you clock this. I did, because it's something that sticks out to me in movies a lot. Do you know how many times they talk about how expensive things are in this movie?
Oh, it's got to be
the cost of things in this movie?
Double digits?
I didn't actually count. Oh, but
it's got to be double digits.
It has to be. And that's the interesting thing this movie's positing. It's like, what's more dangerous to humankind? Corporations who only care about a bottom line, or a species designed to exterminate human life.
Yeah. It's a scary thing that you even have to ask that question, huh?
It sure is. It's terrifying. But here we are. We still have to ask that question. And quite frankly, the corporation's probably worse than this movie.
The funny thing about Paul Reiser, who plays that role, he is the cousin of Will Reiser, who has one screenwriting credit to his name. Never done anything else. He's just got one screenwriting credit. He's done some TV, but one screenwriting credit. He wrote 50-50 because he's the one who had the spine cancer. Yeah, crazy. Crazy that they're related, but I just thought that was a fun little fact there. All right, before we wrap this up, Bill Paxton in this movie as Hudson is, I seriously believe, the best action side character in the history of movies. Every line he says, every action he takes, every movement, everything he does in this movie is pure perfection. And Bill Paxton plays this role so unbelievably. I love this character. Every time I want, you can say everything you want about the girl who plays Newt Stinking as an actress. Because of Bill Paxton, this movie will forever be 4 stars. He takes it up however many notches it needs to be taken up in order for him to overcome Newt's bad performance.
That's reasonable. I mean, it takes so much to have the same machismo that a Marine needs and this, like, terror that Bill Paxton is able to show in some of these scenes. Even, like, the first time we meet Hudson and Bishop's doing the knife trick with him, and he's just, like, yelling the entire time. It's like, holy cow. Like, this is a guy who thinks he's hot shit. And instead, he's like, oh my god, my hand might get stabbed by this android who literally could never stab my hand.
Mm-hmm. Just for some of, like, the gold here, because you can hear it in his voice, Ripley, they cut the power. Him. What do you mean they cut the power? How could they cut the power, man? They're animals. He's also got the great line of, that's it, man. Game over, man. Game over. That's probably one of my favorites. I use that way too often in my life. And then where is the other one? He has another one. Look, let's just bug out and call it even. Okay. What are we even talking about this for? I mean, I forget what the other one is, but he's just got so many gold lines in this movie. And for a side character, a lot of times those can start to feel like cheesy or corny or whatever. We're on an express elevator to hell going down. Yeah. I mean, it's so damn good. And like, it does shock me that with all of the action movies that James Cameron has made, where are these characters in his movies now? Where are the fun supporting characters who are over the top? How did he forget how to write that? That doesn't exist in Avatar. It doesn't exist in Titanic. Like, where is that character?
It's a good question. It was a very good question. Because you would think that it was something that is innate to him and something that he wants in his characters. Maybe he's just, like, the vision of Avatar got ahead of itself and he just couldn't think of the characters that way because of it.
Here's the other line that I wanted to get to. It's this one. Hey, maybe you haven't been keeping up on current events, but we just got our asses kicked, pal. I mean, like you said, it's got the machismo, but then it's got the actual absolute horror and patheticness that it needs to have. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. It's great. There's a real line that happens early in this movie when Ripley's, like, explaining to the company about, you know, the fact that they found this alien, like, these aliens on this planet and everything. And one of the people in the board meeting is like, we've explored 300 planets, like, mm-hmm. and we've never seen this before, so it can't exist. And I'm just sitting here thinking, you know how infinitely vast space is?
I know.
It's baffling. But I love that that's there, because again, it's like, just really reinforces it all. And this movie's great. It is a fun watch. It is a little long. I will put that out
there. It is a little long, but that's why they had to cut out the scene with the daughter so that they didn't add another minute.
Cut out this 5-second scene so that we can just add an extra 20 minutes to this movie's runtime.
I mean, it's crazy that, like, Amanda Ripley has her own section on Wikipedia.
Oh, you're really, like, diving into this now, eh?
Yeah, I am. No, you really blew my mind with that, man. That really bothers me that they cut that. It really, really does. It's crazy. Anyway. All right, we're taking a hiatus, everybody. We're going to be back at the beginning of July. Follow us on social media, all that fun stuff. And we'll be back then. If you want to be a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. Jump in there, become a patron. We're doing $5 Tuesdays. Like I said, we already recorded Rocky II today. We're putting it out next Tuesday. We'll be doing the Muppet movie the week after that. I haven't decided the last two movies for the month of June, but we're going to take just a little break just to give ourselves a little bit of time. Although I'm very happy with the amount of people we had watching live tonight. So maybe I'll make John do a little bit more podcasting, but thank you all so much for listening. Please like this video, like, and subscribe. If you're listening over on iTunes, Audio Boom, any of that fun stuff, leave us a review. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, I don't ever check over there because it makes me sick to my stomach. Cause a lot of times what we'll get is one person who listens one time and it's a guest that they don't like. And they go and they say, I can't believe they had this guest on. He's an asshole. And it's like, well, why are you giving us one star for having a guest? But anyway, go check that out. Give it a, go leave us a review. That would be nice. Hope you enjoyed this. Got through 8 episodes of this series. I don't know if we'll come back to this when we come back from our hiatus, but I do know we're going to jump into the Marvel movies, and that's going to be our real big, our big thing that we're going to make the push on again and get the rest of those movies. What's the next one up in the Marvel movies, John?
That would be Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
Jesus. Okay. So after you just said those words, I think I might never podcast again, but we're going to do it so that it lines up so that we are doing Wolverine and Deadpool right as its opening weekend hits. So that's what the goal is. So stay tuned for when we're going to be doing all of that. Thank you all so much, and we'll see you next time.